Welcome to The Weight of Their Souls, the podcast edition. My name is Debbie Fredericks, and this is episode number 5 of 7. If you want to make a comment or find out more about me, I'll tell you how at the end of this episode. In episode 4, Scala faced great scorn after admitting that his experience in the previous battle had broken his nerve. He led the travelers forward on their journey, despite everyone else wanting to hunt down the incubus, Fingral. And now, episode 5 of The Weight of Their Souls. Until the recent bad times, the road had been maintained by wardens from Withenden. There were signs of neglect, however. Erosion nibbled at the edges of the gravel roadbed. Nonetheless, I was grateful to those wardens, for it was one of their wayhouses we sought. As the day lengthened into twilight, we found it. The wall extended out from a natural overhang, local stones built up low enough to reveal any who approached, yet high enough to offer a meaningful defense. Nearby were a corral, woodshed, and latrine of the same construction. Inside, plain wooden beams supported a slate roof. Benches set along the walls could double as bunks. A standing fireplace with a tall chimney offered the comfort of fire without light to betray our position. At the rear, a pipe jutting from the wall dribbled a steady flow of water into a rock basin. Another provided water to a trough in the corral. A shadow darkened the chamber, and I turned to see Urzel in the doorway. She looked around approvingly. "I can see why you were in such a hurry," the good wife said pleasantly. I shrugged. "I don't know if it'll help, but I want a roof over my head this night." "It won't hurt," she answered, speaking almost to herself. I carried my gear in, dropping it on a bench chosen at random, and led the beasts toward the corral. There was a bit of wood in the shed, I noted, but no hay. Old Boney slurped from the trough, ignoring the donkey when he tried to shoulder his way in. "Get on," I said, remembering the donkey's bite earlier, and shoved old Boney over. The beasts had worked hard for us, so I took off their bridles, laid the saddles over the stone fence, and gave them both a dry brushdown. By the time it was done, the brothers had arrived, and Jeremy with them. I was relieved to see them ride together in the late daylight. As soon as they'd unloaded their gear, I took the horses and sent the two bowmen out to hunt again. Both glanced at me sidelong. I suspected they did my bidding only because it gave them a chance to scout the land. Whatever the cause, they brought back a brace of fat young hares. Easy hunting, they bragged. This told me it had been long since the game in this country saw men. I disliked that. But I tended their horses the same as the others, save Jeremy's charger, which she handled herself. Tufts of tall grass from the nearby hills were dry enough to pull off easily, and I threw down several armloads for the animals. While I did that, I also found a few round purple flowers that I recognized, and so brought back a handful of wild onions to the shelter. Inside, Urzel was all business, skinning and quartering the hares, even as she punctured the bowman's bravado with gentle barbs. You would never have thought she was anything but a good wife. I found myself wondering how many children she had, for she didn't behave as though her order imposed the kind of restriction Jeremy's did. But that was a dangerous line of thought. I turned my eyes to Jeremy instead. Her anger of the morning had given way to sullen brooding. She kept to herself and sharpened her sword. Clearly, the oath-bound knight had not forgiven me for opposing her wishes. It was a relief when Urzel called for supper, not only because it gave us something to do besides not talk to each other and not look at each other, but because the meal was far better than what Fingral had served up. It was plain fare, the hares and onions in their broth, hard bread, dry fruit, cold water. But it wasn't the least bit salty, and that was a pleasure. As all had added to the pot, we ate together, but the scant conversation made the general unease plain enough. They wanted to talk about Fingral, and couldn't while I was there. I ate quickly and finished first. "I'll just go check on the horses," I said, to no one in particular, as I wiped my bowl clean. I could sense them relaxing as I left the shelter and made my way to the corral. I perched myself on a corner of the stone fence, keeping where they could see me, and tried not to think about anything. The sinking sun turned the sky soft colors. Far below in the canyon, the foaming river showed starkly white amid the shadows. To my extreme right, the green hills of Summerdale were just coming into view. I wondered if I would ever see my home again. I shook my head. If I kept thinking like that, I was as good as dead. Glancing over, I could see my companions in a deep consultation, their foreheads close together. I waited and felt my butt grow numb against the hard stones. When they finally started to break up, I slid down and flexed my legs until I could walk without gimping. Once we'd set watches, I rolled out my bedding and lay down on top, armor and all. The gambeson beneath my hauberk was starting to itch, but I had no intention of taking it off. If we saw action during the night, there would be no time to get back into my gear. As a hired sword, I'd learned to sleep no matter where I was. That skill served me well. I put my back to the lamplight and listened to my comrades' quiet movements until sleep claimed me. I didn't rest easily, though, for strange dreams disturbed me. I dreamed of Lisbeth, a girl I knew during an extended assignment in Theling. On a particular day, we'd walked to a secluded meadow and rested beneath the branches, heavy with spring blossoms. I held her warm body against mine and smelled the clove oil she had combed into her hair. It felt very real, the curves of her body and her lingering, sensual kiss. Then she pushed away from me. Under Lisbeth's auburn curls, a pair of gray-brown eyes regarded me. "This is lovely," she breathed, "but I really need you to get the others. Hurry." Still enwrapped in memory, I pulled Lisbeth toward me, as I'd done then, for another hungry kiss. She responded by shifting her weight, and suddenly I found myself pinned beneath her. "Wake up," she insisted, in a voice that was not Lisbeth's. I woke with a jerk in utter darkness. Defensive reflex took over, and I rolled to my feet, grabbing for the dagger that always lay on the ground beside me. The fall from the bench woke me completely. I lay still, feeling a sharp ache in my head and my groin. I smelled dirt and wood smoke and a musty odor that made my heart grow cold. The fog of the river had carried that scent last night. Gods, it was no dream, but Ertzel's call for help. Fearing the worst, I crawled to the bench where the goodwife had been lying. Sure enough, my fumbling hands found an empty bedroll, though the blankets still held a lingering warmth. A sour taste filled my mouth, and no matter how I swallowed, I couldn't get rid of it. If Jeremy became Vingrel's thrall, that would be bad and dangerous. But if he took Ertzel, we were all as good as dead. I crawled around to the side where the brothers should be sleeping and shook the first one my hands found. He woke up swinging, but I half expected that and kept low enough that his fist only grazed my ear. I grabbed his arm and threw myself across his chest so it was trapped between us. "Hey, hey," I rasped. "Calm down, it's me." "What?" Mordecai sounded drowsy and confused. "Oh, Ravenbeard, what the—" "Wake up," I hissed and shook his arm until he shut up. "The witch is gone." "Oh, shit." "Yah!" A flying body struck me from behind just as I was letting go. "Malachi!" His weight threw me back on top of Mordecai, and the three of us rolled in a tangle. "Ow! Hey! Get away from him! Stop it, brother! Let go! I'm not— Brother! Brother!" Mordecai's voice finally prevailed. "It's all right. I'm fine." We all lay still for a moment, and I whispered out what I knew. I was having a weird dream. Then I woke up, and Ertzel was gone. "Oh, shit." "Yeah, oh, shit. Get off me." Bruised and dusty, we managed to separate. It was utterly dark inside the weighhouse, with a queer, oppressive silence that seemed to absorb even Malachi's loud voice. Even so, Jeremy was on watch. She should have cried a challenge. There was no movement from her side of the fire. I didn't like it. The oath-bound knight might be dead, or asleep, or gone. Needing light, I scrambled among the embers, trying not to burn myself as I touched a glowing twig to the lantern wick. Reluctantly, a tiny lick of flame sputtered to life. I shut the glass and turned the wick up slowly. Jeremy was slumped against the warmth of the stone fireplace. It was a miracle I hadn't kicked her in the dark. Until they saw her sleeping, I don't think the brothers really believed me. "What's wrong?" Malachi asked warily. "She'd have to be dead not to hear us," his brother added. "Some kind of black magic," I told them. Staying factual seemed to help keep me calm, so I tersely reported, "It was like this last night, too. He must be nearby. Get your weapons." For once, they stopped arguing and did as they were told. But this left me the task of waking Jeremy. I approached her cautiously. The battle maid slept so soundly that for a moment I thought she wasn't breathing. Her cheeks were flushed, and I saw her fair brow crimp in a frown. Remembering my lustful dreams, I wondered what a woman would dream who was married to her sword. "Sir Knight," I called in a low voice. Not even a twitch. I gripped her shoulder briefly. "Jeremy, wake up." Her breath caught, and I gingerly let go. She merely turned her head and sank back into sleep. I shook her shoulder again, roughly this time. "Jeremy Gentarian, arise!" This time she sprang up, tensing and reaching for her weapon, even as I'd done. For the first moment she glared at me. Then she looked shamefaced. "Did I sleep?" Her voice came thick. "No blame to you," I told her. "It happened to all of us. Are you awake now?" "Aye." "Then there's need of your sword." I gestured toward Urzel's vacant bedding, and her eyes widened in shock. "But I was to be the one," Jeremy protested. I assumed from her words it had never occurred to her that Vingrel might switch targets. It shouldn't have been a surprise, though. Urzel had thwarted him once. He'd want to eliminate the greater threat first. "We can second-guess later," I said. "We've got to get her away from him." "I know," Jeremy answered coldly, "and I wish to say that Brand will forgive you, this once, for touching me." I didn't want to fight with her, so I made the effort to not roll my eyes. "I'll apologize to him later. Come on." You have been listening to The Weight of Their Souls, the podcast edition, read by the author, Debbie Fredericks. If you have any questions or want to make a comment, I'd love to hear from you. Just leave feedback on my blog, Wyrmflight. That's wyrmflight.wordpress.com. I'll do my best to respond to everyone. To find out more about me, you can visit my website, debbyfredericks.com. That's DebbyFredericks.com. I have all sorts of details about my fantasy novels and my children's writing, so please check it out. The music for this podcast was composed and performed by Dexter Britton. It's made available under a Creative Commons license through freemusicarchive.org. All the rest of the production was handled by me, Debbie Fredericks. If there's any kind of problem, it's my fault, but please be nice when you tell me. Both the podcast and the novelette are copyrighted 2013 by Debbie Fredericks. This concludes Episode 5 of The Weight of Their Souls, podcast edition. Thank you for listening.